Well, I welcome all of you to the second lecture in the lecture series of in Baha'i Studies. I take great pleasure to introduce today's lecturer, who's for me, as somebody who is dealing with Iran, is of special importance, and he's scholarship is, we can say, a milestone in Iranian history. Professor Firuz Kazemzadeh was born in 1924 in Moscow, Russia, where his father served for many years on the staff of the Iranian embassy. After completing his primary and secondary education in Moscow, he came to the United States in 1944 and entered Stanford University, graduating with great distinction, Phi Beta Kappa, in 1946 and obtaining an MA in 1947. In 1950, Professor Kazemzadeh received a PhD in Russian history from Harvard. Kazemzadeh has been a fellow in Slavic studies at the Hoover Institution, a consultant to the Department of State, and a research fellow at the Russian Research Center and the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Harvard. He taught at Harvard in 1954 up to 1956, then moved to Yale, where he was professor of history until his retirement as professor emeritus in 1992. At Yale, Professor Kazemzadeh served at various times as chairman of the Council on Russian and East European Studies, chairman of the Committee of Middle Eastern Studies, director of Graduate Studies in Russian and East European Studies program, director of Graduate Studies in History, and Master of Davenport College. He has taught as visiting professor at Harvard, Stanford, Columbia, Lewis and Clark College, and the University of Southern California Law School. He is the author and co-author of books on Russian history and the history of Iran, among them The Struggle for Transcaucasia, 1917-1921, Russia and Britain in Persia, A Study in Imperialism, 1864-1914, and the section on Russo-Iranian relations in the Cambridge History of Iran, Volume 7. His articles and reviews have appeared in the American Historical Review, the Russian Review, the American Slavic Review, the New Republic, the New York Review of Books, the New Leader, the New York Times Book Review, and the World Order, of which he was editor from 1966 to 2000. Professor Kazemzadeh was a member of the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, to which he was appointed for a two-year term in 1998 by President Clinton, and reappointed for another two-year term by Senator Daschle. That's the correct? Okay. Professor Kazemzadeh is a Baha'i, and from 1963 to 2000 served as a member of the National Spiritual Assembly of the Baha'is of the United States, the annually elected governing body of the American Baha'i community. Professor Kazemzadeh will privilege us today talking about the Islamic regime in Iran and the Baha'i faith. Please.
Thank you so much for your kind introduction. I must say at the outset that I talk about the situation of the Baha'is in Iran not from the point of view of an Iranian scholar, but from a point of view of an advocate and a practitioner. I want to be very frank. This is not an attempt at an objective presentation. You yourselves will be able to sift out what is fact and what is opinion, and I will carefully try to label the facts as against opinions by the context of this presentation itself. Now, the Baha'i community in Iran is the largest religious minority in the country. not counting, of course, the Sunni Muslims, because they are still Muslims, and even though they are a minority, they are within the realm of Islam. The number of the Baha'is in Iran is relatively small. There probably are today, even though our statistics may not be too accurate, but I would say about 300,000 Baha'is remain in Iran. Some 40,000 have left. I would estimate that there are at least that many who have not left but have disappeared from sight, because any time that there is a severe persecution, a number of people, not necessarily recanting, not leaving the faith, but not wishing to be known openly as Baha'is, would be somewhere on the fringes of the community, which would bring us to about 400,000, which we estimated we had in Iran before the Islamic Revolution. Now, the persecutions which began with the establishment of the Islamic regime were not something new. These 25 years of persecution were actually a chapter in troubles and difficulties that confronted the Baha'is and their immediate predecessor, the Babis, ever since the inception of this religion. The Shiite clergy wielded enormous influence on the Qajar rulers of Iran. There was no notion of separation of church and state. They were very closely related, closely cooperated, and so the persecutions of the early Babis and Baha'is were directed by both of these forces, and civil society being non-existent, there was no place to hide against the combined assaults of the Shiite clergy and the Iranian government. Then, of course, came modernization and westernization, starting with the inception of the Pahlavi regime in the mid-20s, and that created a different situation. But for the Baha'is, while their conditions somewhat improved, it was not a solution, because the Pahlavi regime also looked upon the Baha'is as a foreign body within the nation, even though the Baha'is ethnically, culturally, in every way except religion, were part and parcel of the general population. If the Baha'i population, the general population of Iran consists, let's say, of 25% Turkish-speaking Azeris, so it was in the Baha'i community. Roughly the same percentage were Baha'is who spoke an Azerbaijani dialect of Turkish, and so down the line. Perhaps there was an inordinately large number in the Baha'i community of converts from the Jewish and Zoroastrian communities, and of course these communities had been persecuted anyway, so they were exchanging one set of persecutions for another set of persecutions, not improving their standing by becoming Baha'i. Now, anti-Baha'i attitudes and anti-Baha'i activities went in phases. There was a kind of initially almost invisible ideological divide there. The early persecutions were in religious terms. That is to say, the original phase, the first phase of enmity toward the Baha'is, was justified from an Islamic theological point of view. If you believe that Muhammad was the seal of the prophets, which means the last one, that all divine revelation ceases with Islam, then anybody who arises and claims divine revelation must be a liar, must be a pretender. And so, theologically, it is impossible that there should be a valid religion after Islam. Before Islam, a few, yes, mentioned in the Quran, Judaism, Christianity, these are real, valid religions. Then, of course, they played around with Zoroastrianism. And because there were too many Zoroastrians in Iran to exterminate, they made of Zoroastrians honorary people of the book, as they called them. In fact, at one time, saying that Zoroaster was Abraham. Now, how do you do this chronologically? Only God knows. But Zoroastrians were given a niche in the Shiite conception of society, accepted religion. And Zoroastrians today are mentioned in the constitution. There were other things in addition to this. The Baha'i religion accepted the Quran as one of the holy books, together with Christian and Jewish scriptures, but the Baha'i faith also taught certain principles which were not acceptable to the Islamic establishment. For instance, the equality of men and women. How could you accept that if the holy books say differently? Or the Baha'i abolition of the notion of ritual uncleanliness, ritual impurity. The Baha'is don't believe in it. Someone asked Baha'u'llah, the founder of the Baha'i religion, can you marry an atheist? You are so liberal, you know, you permit association with all kinds of religions, but can you marry, can a Baha'i marry an atheist? And Baha'u'llah said, yes. Now, in Islam, an atheist is not supposed to be permitted to live. And here, the Baha'is will even permit one of their own to marry an atheist. These, of course, rankle, but also, and I think that this is an important element to which people have not paid enough attention, including scholars, that is that the Baha'i faith dispensed with the clergy. It is a democratic religion. It is run by elected representatives of the people, elected for short periods of time by universal suffrage within the Baha'i community. And so the clergy becomes irrelevant. And you know, the clergy may not even believe in God, but they believe in themselves. And so there was another reason for despising and hating the Baha'i. Now, with the advent of modernization and westernization, among the upper class, there are these people who created a substitute theology. And that is, of course, modern nationalism. It was not a native element. It came from abroad. It came from Germany and France. It was based on European philosophy of nationality, of ethnicity, that had never existed in any Islamic society and had not existed in Iran. But all of a sudden, the value of an individual was gauged not in terms of religious values, but in terms of nationalistic values. And here again, Baha'is were in trouble, because while they were Iranians, either Azerbaijani speaking or Persian speaking, they advocated a kind of internationalism or a supranational outlook, which did not go well with the nationalism that was being promoted by Reza Shah and the Pahlavi, short-lived Pahlavi dynasty in any case. And so the attacks on the Baha'is in the first place were because they were unbelievers, because they were najis, ritually unclean. Now the attacks were no longer in that direction. Now the attacks were they are servants of the foreigners. They like the foreigners. They are not Iranian enough. And even the mullahs, even the Shiite clergy, when they attacked Baha'is, stopped attacking them from religious grounds, but produced documents, purported documents, showing that the Baha'is were servants of the foreigners. The most significant such document, which is still used by the Iranian authorities, was the fake document called The Memoirs of Prince Dolgorukov. Now, Dolgorukov was a very interesting individual. I wish we had time because my field really is Russian history. So if I start talking about Dolgorukov, I'll tell you about his relationship to Nicholas I. Fascinating stuff for me, but irrelevant for us, except to say that Dolgorukov served in the Russian embassy in Iran in the middle of the 19th century, and he was the first Russian envoy, actually, to report the existence of the Babi movement, the precursor of the Baha'i movement. But the first dispatches of Dolgorukov mentioning the Babis date from 1850. And yet in these memoirs, it says, in the memoirs, the supposed Dolgorukov says, I, Dolgorukov, was called in by the Tsar one day. And the Tsar said to me, I want to conquer Iran. But no one will conquer Iran unless first Islam is undermined. I want you, Dolgorukov, to go to Iran, undermine Islam, and then Iran will fall into our hands. So I, Dolgorukov, went to Iran. I found a Sayyid who was light in the head. I gave him a lot of vodka to drink, and I inspired him to proclaim himself to be a prophet of God, and that's how I started the Babi and the Baha'i movement. And these memoirs, there were many curiosities in them. For instance, Dolgorukov, the presumed Dolgorukov, describes this meeting with the Tsar, Nicholas I. And when Dolgorukov speaks to the Tsar, he uses Persian expressions, such as, may my soul be a sacrifice to your majesty. No Russian, Rurikovich, a descendant of the man who founded Russia in the 9th century, ever talked to anybody in such terms. But these people who made up the document didn't know these refinements of Russian culture, so they wrote from a Persian point of view. But now, this document could be funny, and indeed I presented to you this document in a kind of a funny way. But it was used extensively against the Baha'is, and the sad thing is that many Iranian intellectuals swallowed it as genuine. Aha, it was the Russians who really created the Baha'i religion. And then after that, when the relations with Britain deteriorated over the disputes over oil, well, maybe it wasn't just the Russians. Maybe it was the British who originated the Baha'i religion. And there is proof. For instance, when the British occupied Haifa at the end of the First World War, General Allenby, in the name of the British government, knighted Abdul Baha, who was then head of the Baha'i faith. So there was Sir Abdul Baha Abbas. Now, would the English just give a title to anybody? Forget the fact that Abdul Baha had fed the population of Haifa during the Turkish siege, and this is why he was knighted. But obviously, he must have been a British agent. At that time, there was no CIA. But then times progressed, and the CIA was created, and America became a big thing. Uh-huh. Baha'is are agents of the CIA, of the Americans. And, which probably will not surprise you, nowadays Baha'is are Zionist agents. Matthew, how could it be otherwise? So there is this whole series of specific accusations, all of them trying to explain why there are Baha'is in Iran and why they are bad and something ought to be done about this. But you will notice that the attacks now are of a political, nationalistic nature. They are a foreign element. They are servants of outsiders. Now, the attitude of the founders of the Islamic Republic, of Khomeini himself, was expressed by Khomeini even before he got to Iran. In Paris, in December 1978, James Cockcroft of Rutgers University had an interview with Khomeini. And he asked Khomeini certain questions about the future of Iran. And he said, well, you represent a religious movement. Will you have religious freedom in Iran once an Islamic Republic is established? And Khomeini said, yes, yes, there will be religious freedom. Cockcroft pursued this and said, will there be either religious freedom for the Baha'is under the government? And Khomeini replies, they are a political faction. They are harmful. They will not be accepted. And Cockcroft pursues this. Says, how about the freedom of religion, of religious practice? Answer, no. So Khomeini was very plain and straightforward about it. The Iranian government prepared a pamphlet entitled Baha'ism, Its Origin and Its Role, which was presented to the 36th session of the UN Subcommission on the Protection of the Minorities. And there again, no mention of Muhammad, Seal of the Prophets, nothing about ritual and cleanliness, but a whole series of nationalistic accusations. Isn't it interesting that the mullahs themselves are not arguing this from a religious point of view? They're arguing it from a nationalistic point. The claim that the Baha'i faith was created by Western imperialists, Baha'is as agents, spies, etc., etc. In fact, in one article that was presented to the UN by one of the Baha'i delegations, I don't remember now exactly the year, they say they served American imperialists because in the 80s, they received, the Baha'is in America received a letter from Lyndon Johnson in which Lyndon Johnson admitted that the ends and purposes of the Baha'is and of the US government are identical. Well, I happen to have seen this letter. The letter was one of those letters that are ground out at the White House for the 4-H clubs, for Boy Scouts meetings. Whenever in America there is some big event, the people who organize the event send greetings to the president. And in reply comes a standard letter saying, you and I are concerned about the same things, and therefore I wish you the best. And that was the letter of Lyndon Johnson to the Baha'i community. But you take that excerpt, we have the same aims, we work for the same purposes. Well, Lyndon Johnson, President of the United States, admits that they work for the same purposes, therefore against Iran and against Islam. So, once the mullahs achieved domination of Iran, they were set to destroy the Baha'i community. They were working under certain misconceptions. They could not really themselves believe that the Baha'i faith is a religion. They felt that somehow, whether they believed in the theory of foreign manipulation or what, but a bunch of ignorant, stupid people have been led into this society, this community. If you really put some pressure on them, they will evaporate. They will run. They will reconvert to Islam. So, if you behead that community, if you kill off a dozen, two dozen leaders, the sheep will scatter. And so they went after the leadership of the Baha'i community. They arrested and presumably killed, because for more than 25 years, no news of these people has been discovered. The members, the nine members of the National Assembly of the Baha'is of Iran. The Baha'is elected nine other people to take their place. The government arrested those nine also. the Baha'is elected 9 again, and most of those were arrested, and many of them disappeared without a trace. There had been, under the Pahlavis, a society called the Hujjatiyin Society, which had a subtitle of Anti-Baha'i Society. And that society was not only tolerated by the Pahlavi regime, but encouraged, because the anti-Baha'i activity was a way of distracting the mullahs from their hatred of the Pahlavis themselves. The mullahs obviously didn't like either Reza Shah or Muhammad Reza Shah. So you threw a bone to the mullahs every once in a while. You did something that pleased them in order to prevent them from concentrating on the Shah and his regime. So this society was quite active, and now that Khomeini was in power, now that the Islamic regime was established, that Hujjatiyya society conducted a very vigorous anti-Baha'i campaign. And in the first years after the revolution, there was a lot of anarchy in the country as well. So there were sort of private attacks on the Baha'is by these various groups of mullahs, and it is very difficult to distinguish them from the actions of the government. But this was the period when the largest number of Baha'is were arrested, and some were killed. In September 1983, the Prosecutor General, the Chief Legal Officer of the country, officially outlawed the Baha'i faith. Now, the Baha'i faith is not mentioned in the Iranian constitution. The constitution mentions three so-called heavenly religions, which is Judaism, Christianity, and Zoroastrianism. So the Baha'is then have no status as a religion. But the judiciary interpreted the absence of the mention of the Baha'is and the fact that the Baha'i religion appeared after Islam as a license to issue fatwas, to issue proclamations explaining what the Baha'i faith and the Baha'i community actually are. For instance, a certain Hujjatul Islam Qazai in February 1983 issued a fatwa which was reported in the press, February 83, Akhbar Junub, the Southern News newspaper, and this is what he said. The Iranian nation has arisen in accordance with Quranic teachings, and by the will of God has determined to establish a government of God on earth. Therefore, it cannot tolerate the perverted Baha'is, who are the instruments of Satan and the followers of the devil and of the superpowers and their agents. It is absolutely certain that in the Islamic Republic of Iran, there is no place whatsoever for Baha'is or Baha'is, which is condemned by reason and logic. Otherwise, the day will come when the Islamic nation will deal with the Baha'is in accordance with its religious obligations, and will, God willing, fulfill the prayer of Noah mentioned in the Quran. And Noah said, Lord, leave not one single family of infidels on earth. Now, I suppose Noah would disclaim this statement. It does not appear in the older sources than the Quran, but this is the point of view of this particular individual, which was shared by the Islamic establishment. And right there in Shiraz, where these statements were made, shortly thereafter, a number of Baha'is were killed, including 10 young women who were hanged, publicly hanged, because they taught religion classes to Baha'i children. Now, there were also expropriations, not only of Baha'i community property, all of Baha'i community property was taken over, completely. Some of it had been taken over, in fact, a little bit earlier under the Pahlavis, but that was minor. Now, with the establishment of the Islamic Republic, particularly after September 83, there was a total large-scale expropriation of all community property, including cemeteries, schools, libraries, Baha'i centers, everywhere in the country. And this sometimes extended beyond community properties to private properties as well. Many, many people lost their homes. The loss of cemeteries was painful. The cemetery in Tehran, for instance, contained the remains of many, many distinguished Baha'is. And also in Iranian culture, as in some other cultures, there was a reverence for the burial place of one's family, of one's fathers and grandfathers. So this was very painful when bulldozers came and bulldozed the graves and destroyed the cemeteries. Then there was the question of employment. A Baha'i could not be employed by the government, and the theological explanation, of course, was, first of all, he is a heretic, he will spread bad ideas, but also there is a question of whether it is licit to spend the community's money on an infidel. If you are an infidel working for me and I pay you, I have supported an infidel and infidelity. So you cannot employ these infidels and pay them communities, Muslim communities, money. And so the employment of the Baha'is was terminated. And in Iranian society, this had more severe consequences than it would have in some other societies. I cannot speak of the situation in Israel, but in the United States, for instance, railroads are privately owned. Airlines are privately owned. Many universities are private universities. The percentage of American population employed by the government is relatively small. Of course, everybody complains the bureaucracy is too large, etc., etc. But in fact, it is only, 7 or 8% of the people who are directly employed by the government. My figures may be not exact. In Iran, it was different. In Iran, the railroad was government. The airline was government. Many, many institutions, which in other countries would be private, in Iran, were government institutions. And so, right at the start, some 10,000 people lost their jobs. Beyond that, people who had already retired lost their pensions. Beyond that, if it is a sin to pay government or community money to an infidel, then those who had worked for the government before should pay these monies back. And so they made demands on Baha'is to repay the salaries that they gained or the pensions that they had received. It was really an exceptional thing. Now let me just give you one or two for the flavor of it, examples. According, this is a Baha'i receiving a letter from his superiors in this company. It says, according to the confidential letter 3005 from the Security Department, it is in no way possible to issue a work permit to Mr. J.F. It should be remembered, according to his request, dated November 2nd, and this is later, much later than the time that I described, November 2nd, 1988, he has introduced as his religion the wayward Baha'i sect, which is the agent of Zionism and the United States, and he considers himself a Baha'i. therefore he cannot be given a work permit. And this can be multiplied. There was one which I liked particularly, written to a veterinarian who was employed by the Ministry of Agriculture, telling him that because he was a Zionist agent, which means a Baha'i, you know, Zionism is a code word for the Baha'i religion. Maybe some of you didn't know about that, but I welcome you to the Baha'i community. Those of you who happen to be Zionists. So this sort of thing then went on. Demands of repayments of salaries, denials of pension. Another thing which was very, very significant and which really hurt the Baha'i community is the denial of higher education to Baha'i youth. The Baha'is are a bookish people. They pay a lot of attention to education. Universal education is one of the basic principles of the Baha'i faith. And I'm sure again that in a Jewish community this will find a resonance, because you will certainly understand what it means. You know, parents constantly telling the boy and the girl, go get educated. And in the Baha'i religion, interestingly enough, the education of girls was placed ahead of the education of boys. If the parents are too poor to educate a son and a daughter, preference should be given to the daughter, because she will be the first teacher of the next generation. So to perpetuate learning and education, you have to pay attention to the education of daughters. Well, Baha'is were excluded from higher education. In 1991, the president of the Islamic Republic, at that time Rafsanjani, and the supreme leader, the Faqih, the law expert of the Republic, Khomeini, asked a certain cultural committee of the Islamic Revolution to prepare a statement as to what policy should be assumed in order to limit or to eradicate the Baha'i community in Iran. And a very, very interesting document emerged. In this document, in this Golpoigani memorandum, as I call it, people have also referred to it as a blueprint for the destruction of the Baha'i community, it specifies that the Baha'is should be denied higher education, that they should be denied an opportunity of accumulating wealth, because obviously this becomes a means for the support of the community. The document was accepted by Rafsanjani and Khomeini with their thanks, and copies were sent to the governors of all the provinces in Iran and to various government offices, and obviously therefore could not be kept secret. And so copies of the document reached abroad, and the United Nations obtained the copy and published it, and it is listed now as one of the official UN documents. Now, in this situation, how did the Baha'is react? Well, they tried their best to remain faithful to their religion spiritually in the first place. Baha'is cannot recant their faith, and they are not permitted to dissimulate their faith. Ketman or Tariyeh, which is permissible in particularly in Shiite Islam, is not permissible in the Baha'i faith. This is the one instance where you literally take your life in your hand. You don't have to advertise that you're a Baha'i, but if constituted authorities officially ask you, what is your religion, you may not conceal the fact that you are a Baha'i, even if you are threatened with death. So the Baha'is did the number of those who concealed their religion or who recanted was amazingly small. In a community of some 300,000, only a few hundred chose to do that, which is amazing. When you compare, for instance, and please don't misunderstand me, I'm not casting aspersions on any religion, but during the Diocletian's persecutions of early Christians in the Roman Empire, when there were persecutions, severe persecution of Christians, one third to one half of the Christian community would recant. Usually temporarily, they would come back after the persecution is over. So when you have less than 1% recanting, these are really most unusual figures. The Baha'i community has survived for a variety of reasons. One of them, this strong determination not to give in, strong determination not to recant. Also, mutual assistance. The Baha'is developed an informal network of mutual assistance. So when they lost jobs, when they lost homes, others came to their assistance. There are no hungry Baha'is in Iran today. There is no destitution in the Baha'i community in spite of all the pressure, because of this family feeling, because the community is tightly knit. They have also lived up to their principle of not resorting to violence. And this is very important to the Baha'is, because they believe that the end does not justify the means. You know, Lenin said, and he was quoting, I believe, some 19th century Englishman, that you cannot make an omelet without breaking eggs, and there are varieties of that statement in various literary sources. But you also cannot spread a white tablecloth with bloody hands. The ends that you pursue have to correspond to the means that you employ. There have been bombs thrown at high officials, a president was murdered, hundreds of Islamic officials were killed, not one instance of a Baha'i participating. Then the issue of Iranian Baha'is being agents of the foreigners. When the American embassy in Tehran was taken over by the Islamic so-called students, they got hold of the whole file of the State Department correspondence with the embassy in Tehran and of the local resident of the CIA. And the Americans did not do a very good job shredding these documents, and Persians, as you may know, are experts at making these beautiful boxes with inlays of ivory and colored wood and all that. So a couple of hundred people sat there, specialists from the bazaar who made these things. They sat there with tweezers and they put together all those pieces of paper, and they published something like 30 volumes of CIA documents. By now we're 80, all right, 80 volumes, I'm told. Not one instance of a Baha'i having cooperated with the CIA or worked as a spy. Not one in all that tremendous number of documents. So what does that show you? Also, various trials of spies and foreigners, etc. Not one, literally, document has been presented showing Baha'i involvement. And in all the documents that the Iranian government presented to the United Nations in their attempts to exculpate themselves in persecuting the Baha'is, not a single document has ever been produced. So this is another reason why the Baha'i community survived, because when you have been barraged for more than 100 years by the mullahs with the ideas of Baha'is being traitors, being evil, being subversive, being saboteurs, being foreign agents, then you have all that kind of documentation, then all but the most hard-hearted begin to doubt the righteousness of persecution. And even among the mullahs there were some who got fed up with this kind of thing. Now they knew better. And so the ardor was out, was no longer there. Now, this will be another document. So, the Baha'is, as I said, did not participate in violence. They remained loyal citizens. And the persecutors themselves began to realize that they were not subversive or dangerous. Then the Baha'is were able to their institutions, of course, were closed, and obeying the law, the Baha'is did not reconstitute them. But they developed an informal network of leadership. I suppose it was largely helped in the initial stages by the fact that in a small community, relatively speaking, small community, people know each other, and they know who the elders are, who the white beards, so to speak, Rish Sefidai, John, who they are, and they gravitated towards certain individuals, and then gradually this was more or less formalized, so they maintained a structure. They maintained the structure of what they call 19-day feasts, which is a regular event that the Baha'is attend in private homes, in a couple of hundred places, for instance, in the city of Tehran alone. Then they went beyond that. Since Baha'i youth were denied the right to attend universities, they started their own university. The Baha'i community was rich in educated talent. They had professors in almost any field that you want. One of the finest hospitals in Iran, the Nisariyeh Hospital, had a whole staff of doctors. There were professors of medicine at Tehran University. These people now taught younger Baha'is in garages, in private homes. They created underground laboratories. They created libraries which were spread over maybe 50 or 100 private homes. So if you wanted to read on certain topics, you had to move from one home to another. But still, they made it possible for these young people to become educated. And on the other side, for instance, in the United States, we made an agreement with the University of Indiana, one, and some other colleges, where the Baha'is graduating from this underground university would be administered University of Indiana examinations proctored by graduates of the University of Indiana, and then they would be issued certificates by the University of Indiana, so that when they went abroad, they could go to legitimate colleges and universities for their graduate education. Now this Baha'i Open University or Baha'i Institute of Higher Education has been repeatedly attacked. There have been police raids, books have been confiscated. In one instance, what was the number? I don't remember, 50 computers or something were in fact stolen, taken away. But the Baha'is persist, and that underground university still functions and provides at least some relief to the Baha'is. So this is another element that helped the community to survive. Now there were other elements as well. Some domestic, how much more time do you have? There were some other elements that helped survival. There was the moral support of the entire Baha'i world. Baha'i communities in Europe, in America, in Australia, mobilized for the support of the Iranian Baha'i community. They were able to mobilize public opinion. I myself participated with this, and we were able to obtain statements of support from President Reagan, for instance, from President Clinton. Senator Hines of Pennsylvania helped us a great deal before he tragically died in an airplane crash. Joe Lieberman, who was my neighbor in New Haven for many years and a good friend, was very helpful. Senator Dodd of Connecticut, many people of that stature helped us. And the United States Congress passed resolutions 8 times in the last 25 years condemning the persecution of the Baha'is. Even the Swiss Parliament passed a resolution in support of the Baha'is. Australian Parliament, the British Parliament. In fact, there is a, I don't even remember the exact title, but in the British House of Commons, there is a parliamentary group of friends of the Baha'is or something like that, who keep agitating and pushing the British government to give support to the Baha'is. So in Canada, in Australia, in the United Kingdom, and in many other countries, such Baha'i resolutions were passed. Now, it was not always easy to mobilize public opinion, especially in the early stages, because in the West, there was a great deal of misplaced idealism about the Islamic Revolution. I myself had a meeting with Ramsey Clark, who was under Carter, Attorney General of the United States. Now, Ramsey Clark is a very liberal gentleman. he has just been employed by Saddam Hussein to be one of his lawyers defending Saddam Hussein. Well, Ramsey Clark, when I met with him and I said, would you make a statement in support of the Baha'is, would you give us some help and assistance? He says, I'm afraid I will not, because the Baha'is were supporters of the Shah and the Baha'is worked for the Savak. Now, he had swallowed that same propaganda. He did not mention Dolgorukov's memoirs, but that was the only thing he didn't mention. But he doesn't know about Dolgorukov, yes. But he refused. Another prominent individual who is a professor at the university, but I don't want to mention a colleague's name, wrote an op-ed piece in the American press, and he said, modernity, as we know it, was a result of the thought of two great individuals. One was Karl Marx, who taught us about the structure of society. The other one is Sigmund Freud, who taught us about the structure of the human mind. What modernity lacked was a third genius who would have given us the same kind of understanding of the spiritual structure of humanity. Khomeini did that. Well, you know, what can I say? What kind of a comment can I make? Again, that gentleman is a very nice person, and in his own field, he is a fine scholar. But you see, being a fine scholar in one field does not make you specialist in everything. Einstein used to complain that young ladies wrote him letters asking for his advice in marital matters. Well, Einstein's marriage wasn't very happy anyway, but if you are an Einstein, of course you know everything. So here you have an example of decent people, nice people, taking positions which were incredibly bad, but these were fortunately in the minority. The Baha'is did receive a great deal of support from academics. For instance, when attacks were made on this Baha'i University, this informal Baha'i University, we had presidents of several dozen American universities, including presidents of Yale and Harvard and Duke University and Stanford, protesting against these actions of the Iranian government. Well, the situation today, very briefly, the situation of the individual Baha'is has improved. There are still occasional arrests, a lot of harassment, but they have given up on the notion of exterminating the community by brute force. There have not been killings, and if you are quiet and mind your own business, you can live, more or less. In other words, it is like this. It is not today in Iran like the situation of the Jews in Germany in 1938, but like the situation of the Jews in Tsarist Russia, in Western Russia, in the Ukraine, someplace in Gomel or Vitebsk or Minsk under the Tsars. That kind of a pressure and persecution, but not on a major scale. However, for the Baha'i community, that has not been let up. Baha'is have no clergy. The community is run by these elected assemblies who have a quasi-sacramental character for us. They are our clergy. We elect them, but they solemnize our marriages. They, as one member of the American National Assembly said years ago, we marry them and bury them. But we cannot have these institutions. And this is our first demand, our first need. The destruction of the Baha'i holy places proceeds. Just last June, they destroyed the house that belong to the father of Baha'u'llah, the founder of the Baha'i faith. The house, if you want to be technical about it, never belonged to the Baha'is, right? It was built by a Muslim who was a famous political figure and Iran's finest calligrapher in the early 19th century, Mirza Bozorgi Nuri. It was an example of late 18th, early 19th century Islamic architecture. In fact, Muslim writers, the artistic preservation society of Iran protested against the destruction of the building. Why did they destroy it? They learned that that building had belonged to the father of Baha'u'llah, who founded the Baha'i faith. Therefore, destroy the building. So this sort of thing continues. Recently, the Baha'i community sent an appeal to President Khatami, saying in essence, you know, you talk about freedom and liberalization and whatnot, what about the Baha'is? And they list all the disabilities. Well, like in some classical play, the bearer of the message was arrested and put in jail. And several others who took the message to the head of police, to various government officials, to make it known to them, they were arrested. Fortunately, they were not kept for long. I understand that they have been all released. But this gives you an idea of the continuing harassment. There is no recognition of the Baha'is as a permissible religion. But, and I told you that I am not going to speak here as an objective and scholarly presenter. I speak as an advocate. I am convinced that they are going to fail. They are not going to win this battle. The Baha'i community will survive, and maybe 50 years from now, someone else in your Center for Baha'i or Iranian Studies will give you a more objective presentation with documents about how the Baha'i community has survived and how it is prospering in a freer Iran. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Kazemzadeh, for giving us the opportunity to have a penetrating look into the situation of the Baha'is in Iran. The floor is open now to questions, so please.